The following message was preached at Redeemer Community Church. For more information about Redeemer, visit us online at www.redeemernc.org.
Today's scripture reading comes from Esther chapter 3, verses 7 through 11. In the first month, the month of Nisan, in King Ahasuerus' 12th year, the Pur, that is the lot, was cast before Haman for each day in each month, and it fell on the 12th month, the month Adar. Then Haman informed King Ahasuerus, "There is one ethnic group scattered throughout the peoples in every province of your kingdom, keeping themselves separate. Their laws are different from everyone else's, and they do not obey the king's laws. It is not in the king's best interest to tolerate them. If the king approves, let an order be drawn up authorizing their destruction, and I will pay 375 tons of silver to the officials for deposit in the royal treasury." The king removed his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman, son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. Then the king told Haman, "The money and people are given to you to do with as you see fit." This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God. You may be seated. If you have your Bibles, turn to Esther 2. We'll look at Esther 2 and 3 this morning. A number of years ago, I learned about the controversy that sometimes swirls around movie posters. I don't know about you, but I don't give a lot of thought to movie posters. There's a few classic ones I can picture in my mind, but for the most part, I don't care. But apparently, if your face is actually on the movie poster, then you care a little more about it. In fact, everything, including who's on it and their position relative to the other faces, can produce arguments. So I first heard about this when a movie was released that was co-starring a famous actor and actress. So on the movie poster, the actor's face is centered and he's staring right into the camera. The actress's face is a little off to the side, and instead of looking at the camera, she's looking at him. And apparently this was a big deal because she felt as if, though she was a co-star and was receiving the same billing, that on the poster, her placement to the side was some sort of affront. She was a star, and she wanted everyone to acknowledge it, but it didn't come through on the poster, in her opinion. Last week, Don introduced us to the book of Esther. In Act 1, Scene 1, we saw the setting. There's this mighty superpower that goes all the way from Egypt to India. And then he introduces us to one character, this king who works really hard to impress everyone with how powerful he is, but he ends up looking like a fool. Now here in chapters 2 and 3, we're introduced to the other main characters. And we don't know yet what role everyone plays. Like, who's the star? Who's the hero? Are there co-stars? Is there a villain? And most importantly, what are we supposed to learn? What are these characters supposed to teach us about our faith and obedience? So this morning, we're going to look at four primary characters in the drama. And we're going to begin by looking closer at the one who was introduced to us in chapter 1. Let's meet him. Our first character is a juvenile bully. If you missed last week, let me bring up to speed. You have King Ahasuerus, who rules over this gigantic empire, and he tries to impress everyone with how powerful he is, so he throws this 6-month-long party. Pretty impressive. And this party is designed around two things. One is displaying his wealth for everyone to see, and two, getting everyone drunk. I guess so they'll be even more impressed with his wealth. Well, as the party winds down, this is what we saw last week, he wants to show off his most prized possession, his most beautiful object, so he calls in his wife. He says, "I want you to come, and I want your beauty to be displayed so everyone will see how impressive I am." And his wife refuses. And so he gets angry at her refusal, and he publicly removes her as queen, and then he sends out the worst press release in history, because it basically takes something that could have been small, and it blows up into something big, and everyone realizes how much of an idiot he is. Well, chapter 2, where we start this morning, picks up with this mourning after regret from the king. Vashti was beautiful, and even though he's the king and she's beautiful, in a lot of ways now she's off limits to him because of this very public decision he's made. So Ahasuerus, he wears an impressive crown, he sits on a big throne, but he's a child. And sadly, he's a child with a lot of power that he uses to hurt other people. I just want you to imagine how much damage a bully could do if he had an arsenal full of powerful weapons. Well, that's what we see in this king. That he's a man-child emphasis on the child. Look at verse 1 of chapter 2. It says, "Sometime later, when King Ahasuerus' rage had cooled down, he remembered Vashti, what she had done and what was decided against her. The king's personal attendant suggested, 'Let a search be made for beautiful young virgins for the king. Let the king appoint commissioners in each province of his kingdom so that they may gather all the beautiful young virgins to the harem at the fortress of Susa. Put them under the supervision of Haggai, the king's eunuch, keeper of the women, and give them the required beauty treatments. Then the young woman who pleased the king will become queen instead of Vashti.' This suggestion pleased the king, and he did accordingly." If we look in verse 1, we see how immature this king is, because he refuses to take any responsibility for his actions. In fact, there seems to be some level of regret about what he did in his drunken haste. But notice it's not his fault. Notice how it's described in verse 1. He remembers what she had done. And then remembered, this is the worst, what was decided against her. Now who made the decision against her? He did. He's certainly influenced by these sniveling yes men around him, but it was his decision. But with like a child, he refuses to accept any responsibility. And it gets worse. What caused this regretful decision that was made against Vashti? And the answer was, it was his self-indulgence. It was his partying, his drinking. But because he doesn't accept responsibility, then he embraces this stupid plan that is basically more self-indulgence. The book of Proverbs describes a fool as a dog who returns to his own vomit. Now, I have dogs. I love dogs. They're not really smart animals. You can teach them a few things, but they're just creatures of instinct and habit. No matter how good you train them, like, they want something else. They want whatever they want at that moment. And that's what Proverbs is saying. A fool is like a dog, because a dog will eat something, it'll get sick, so its body will get rid of that thing. So what will the dog do? Like, well, that tasted good, so I'll go eat it again. And the same thing will happen. So like a dog returning to his vomit, like a six-year-old who eats more cotton candy even though he's just thrown up, Ahasuerus, he thinks this is a great idea. Like, I have this bitter taste from my last self-indulgence in my mouth. How about I get over the bitter taste by more self-indulgence? You see, everyone looks at Ahasuerus and they see this great kingdom. They see this impressive throne. They see all these beautiful decorations in chapter 1. They say, wow, he's so impressive. And we're supposed to look at him and say, what a child. Notice how he never comes up with an idea himself. Others are always telling him what to do. So in the previous chapter, whose idea was it to get rid of Vashti and then make this press release that is actually humiliating to the king? It wasn't his idea. In this chapter, whose idea is it to exploit all of these young women? It's not his idea. In the next chapter, we'll see he's manipulated again. He's a child. But he's a really, really dangerous one. And in his immaturity, in his selfishness, he approves this plan that is going to wreck the lives of countless young women, destroying their futures, destroying the hopes their families had for them. So when the book opens, we think maybe the king of this powerful nation, maybe he's the prominent face on the movie poster. But now we see he's just a pawn. He's a child. He's a weak man who just finds himself because of where he was born, who he was born to, in this position of power. And though his decisions impact lives and they impact nations, he's unimportant. He's just a footnote in the story. Maybe this is a good reminder to us that those who often at first glance seem so impressive, so powerful, those who seem so important, often have the least impact on us. Those in positions of power, they have far less control than we give them credit for. This king is also a reminder to us of why Jesus is so great. Because Jesus, unlike Ahasuerus, he doesn't take advantage of people. And though all power and authority in all the universe belongs to him, he's not selfish. He's not self-indulgent. Jesus doesn't harm others to get his own way. In fact, the story we read in the Bible of Jesus is Jesus gives up everything to go and rescue his unfaithful bride and make her queen. So the more that we learn to see through the self-promotion of human leaders, the more we should long for the return of our king who gives himself to us in love. Let's look at the second character. He's a righteous exile. His name is Mordecai, He's introduced to us very briefly, but there's a few important details. He's a Jew who lives in exile in Persia, who's adopted a younger orphaned cousin. Verse 5, it says, in the fortress of Susa, there was a Jewish man named Mordecai, son of Jair, son of Shimei, son of Kish, a Benjaminite. Kish had been taken into exile from Jerusalem with the other captives when King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon took King Jeconiah of Judah in exile. Mordecai was the legal guardian of his cousin Hadassah, that is Esther, because she had no father or mother. The young woman had a beautiful figure and was extremely good looking. When her father and mother died, Mordecai had adopted her as his own daughter. So we're given a little bit of his family background. Mordecai comes from the tribe of Benjamin. He's a descendant of Kish, and Kish is the father of Israel's first king, King Saul. And we're going to see in a few moments how that detail becomes important. Verse 6 tells us he's in exile. And though it doesn't come through in our English translations, it's mentioned four times. Verse 6 could read like this. Kish had been taken into exile from Jerusalem with the other exiles when King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon exiled King Jeconiah of Judah into exile. So it's an important detail. And we're supposed to say, well, what? Why are the Jews in exile? And the answer is because of their repeated sin. Like the Jewish people, though given the law of God, given the grace of God, they persist in disobedience and idol worship. And so God, as a result, he allows them to be defeated and dragged away into punishment. And though by this time many of the Jews have been allowed to return, many are still living as exiles in this foreign land. And we're supposed to see here the weakness of God's people. This is not a strong, mighty, self-sufficient nation. Their sin has left them vulnerable and powerless. So Mordecai, he's a descendant of King Saul, and he's in exile, and neither of these details tell us anything about his character. The first thing we learn about his character is that he has adopted a young orphan named Esther. He has become a father to the fatherless. If you're familiar with the Old Testament law, then this would lead you to identify this act as righteous because it mirrors God's own righteousness. So Mordecai, the first thing we learn about what he does is he imitates God by caring for someone who's weak and vulnerable. Now, we don't know yet what role Mordecai will play in the story. And before we learn anything else about him, the spotlight shifts to our third character, which is Esther, a gorgeous victim. Now, the very first detail we learn about Esther, she has two names. One name is Hebrew, one name is Persian, and maybe this is a signal to us about how difficult it is to live as an exile in a different land. And as Christians, we should identify with her. We should identify with the struggle of having an identity that is at odds with the identity and the culture around us. The next thing we learn about her is that she's an orphan, that she's dealt with suffering, that her life has not been easy, it's been hard. And then we're told, verse 7, that she is drop-dead gorgeous. In fact, we're sold in a somewhat crass way that she has both a beautiful face and a great body. That's a little weird, isn't it? In fact, I'll be honest, it feels a little weird to be up in front of you and say the phrase, she has a great body. But that's what the text says. And why is this important? Because as we'll see, as we saw last chapter, as we'll continue to see, this is what matters in Persia. What matters in Persia is not the content of a person's character, but the quality of their skin. They are judged on their appearance. Do you remember chapter 1 and the king's fascination with beautiful things, right? Beautiful colors, beautiful things, beautiful couches made of gold, a beautiful object to be displayed in front of everyone else. And so this description of Esther is one of the first things about her is it's helping us, it's preparing us for what's to come, that what's most important about her, at least in the estimation of the society that she finds herself in, is simply how she looks. Friends, let's not pretend that this is any different than what we see in our culture, with our deep fascination over appearances. How people appear is more important than who they are. Their image is more important than their character. In fact, Persia is a lot like Instagram, where physical beauty is a form of currency, and in Esther's case, she's rich in it. Her beauty catches the eye of the assistant who's in charge of this sort of sexually exploitative program that the king is running. And so he prepares Esther for her turn to meet the king. Look at verse 8. When the king's command and edict became public knowledge, and when many young women were gathered at the fortress of Susa under Haggai's supervision, Esther was taken to the palace into the supervision of Haggai, keeper of the women. The young woman pleased him and gained his favor so that he accelerated the process of the beauty treatments and the special diet that she received. He assigned 7 handpicked female servants to her from the palace and transferred her and her servants to the harem's best quarters. We find out in verses 10 and 11 that though she no longer lives with Mordecai, he is still protective of her. In fact, he checks on her regularly and he cautions her not to reveal her identity as a Jew. Now, we're not told what his motive was in urging her to keep this a secret. It'll come up again later in the chapter that he tells her, don't tell him you're a Jew. But one thing we know is true from later in the story, that being known as a Jew can be very dangerous. Well, Esther's turn finally comes to meet the king. It's important that we understand what's happening here because the version that we tell in Sunday school on flannel graph glosses over some of the finer details. We sanitize a story that has nothing sanitary about it. I don't know if you've ever looked at the stories, the fairy tales, the original ones that often are turned into Disney movies. They don't usually end like the Disney movies. They actually end much darker normally. And this story is something like that the Brothers Grimm would write, not Disney. It's less like Cinderella, it's more like Taken. So here's what's happening. Night after night, King Ahasuerus, he has another virgin girl from his kingdom brought into his bed. And if he's pleased with her, there is a chance that she'll be made the next queen. If he's not pleased with her, then she is sent on this walk of shame to a different part of his estate where she is going to live the rest of her life as a concubine, which is not really a wife because she's not free to marry anyone else or bear kids. And in a way, what she has done is if she doesn't please him in bed, she is exiled, just like the nation of Israel. This is horrific. And we should be appalled and disgusted by the way that Ahasuerus, he takes his power and he uses it to violate others for his own pleasure. You see, the Bible doesn't sugarcoat how wicked the world really is. Maybe you're in a situation where you have been subject to great wickedness. You've been victimized by someone else. And maybe you wonder if the Bible can speak to your situation. Yes, it can. It speaks honestly about how wicked our world is, and it exposes it as being wicked, not how it should be. We live in a world, sadly, that exploits people. Christopher Ashe wrote, he said, "We inhabit a world where powerful people treat other people as existing merely for their benefit, rather than having dignity in their own right." And when anyone looks at pornography, they do the same thing as the king does here. They treat someone made in the image of God as an object for their enjoyment. Men, when you pull up an image on your phone or computer, you have turned a living, breathing soul into an object for you to use and discard. You've used it like the wrapping that comes in your Amazon package. It's something for your benefit. And as soon as you're done with it, you toss in the trash. It's nothing to you. One author described these women as living dolls and says those chosen would live in secluded splendor for the rest of their lives, even if they were only rarely taken out and played with. So what happens when Esther is finally summoned? When her year of being pampered and shaped for the king's enjoyment finally ends, what happens when she is brought into the king's bedchamber? Verse 16, she was taken to King Ahasuerus in the palace in the 10th month, the month Tebeth in the 7th year of his reign. The king loved Esther more than all the other women. She won more favor and approval from him than did any of the other virgins. He placed the royal crown on her head and made her queen in place of Vashti. The king held a great banquet for all his officials and staff. It was Esther's banquet. He freed his provinces from tax payments and gave gifts worthy of the king's bounty. Now, a lot of people, a lot of Christians, when they read through the story, they want to focus on what Esther should have done. Should Esther have gone along with this? Should Esther have compromised what appears to be a compromise, or should she have been willing to suffer the consequences? Should she have refused to go in the king? And here's the reality. We're not given enough information to really know all of the details. to make that decision. The writer of Esther isn't concerned with that question. There are plenty of other places in the Bible that are concerned with that question, that tell us, guide us for decision making. But this particular one, he doesn't give us all the details in order to make that decision because he doesn't want us to speculate in what ifs. Like, that's not the thing. Because when we speculate in what ifs, whether in the story of Esther or in our own lives, it's easy for us to miss what God is doing and what God is calling us to do when we sit there and go, like, what if that happened? Or what if I made a different decision there? Or what if this had happened? And so in this case, we're not supposed to speculate on the what ifs. We're supposed to see God at work in the situation, all the nastiness and all the brokenness of the situation. You see, Esther's the new queen. But we know from chapter 1 that having the crown placed on her head is no guarantee of her safety. Like, she may wear a crown, but she is still subject to the whims of this juvenile child king. Now the scene shifts back from Esther back to Mordecai, and we're given another example that he's righteous. Even though he's in exile, he acts with integrity. Look at verse 19. When the virgins were gathered a second time, Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate. Esther still did not reveal her family background or her ethnicity as Mordecai had directed. She obeyed Mordecai's orders, as she always had while he raised her. Now, during those days, while Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, Bigthan and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who guarded the entrance, became infuriated and planned to assassinate King Ahasuerus. When Mordecai learned of the plot, he reported it to Queen Esther, and she told the king on Mordecai's behalf. When the report was investigated and verified, both men were hanged on the gallows. This event was recorded in the historical record in the king's presence. So think about this. Chapter 2 ends with Mordecai saving the king's life. Chapter 3 begins with someone receiving a promotion. Mordecai saves the king's life. Someone's getting promoted. These events should be connected, right? Look at chapter 3, verse 1. After all this took place, what? The king's life being saved. King Ahasuerus promoted. Haman, son of Hammedatha the Agagite. He promoted him in rank and gave him a higher position than all the other officials. So instead of promoting the righteous exile, the king promotes a man named Haman and introduces us to the fourth character, a vindictive official. So we learn three things about Haman right away. First, he's an Agagite. So the name Agag, actually, it pulls us back in biblical history to a particular time when Israel was fighting against the Amalekites. So the Amalekites, they were longtime enemies of the nation of Israel. They had refused, when Israel was on the way to the Promised Land, they'd refused to let Israel pass through their land. In fact, they'd attacked them and tried to harm them. So this had been a sworn enemy of the Amalekites. So God commanded King Saul, we've talked about him, right? King Saul to go and kill the Amalekites, and he does, sort of. He kills them all except for one man, their king, whose name is Agag. And so you have a descendant of Saul in Mordecai, you have a descendant of Agag in Haman. We'll come back to that. Second thing we know about him is not just an Agagite, he's promoted to prime minister. We don't know why. We don't know if he's earned this. We don't know if he's a good choice for it. We know nothing about it other than he's promoted. And the third thing we know is that Mordecai has a problem with him. Because even though the king commands everyone to bow down to Haman, Mordecai refuses in verses 2 through 4. Haman's not aware of Mordecai's refusal until some servants bring this to his attention. But once he learns, he goes nuclear. Verse 5, when Haman saw that Mordecai was not bowing down or paying him homage, he was filled with rage. And when he learned of Mordecai's ethnic identity, it seemed repugnant to Haman to do away with Mordecai alone. He planned to destroy all of Mordecai's people, the Jews, throughout Ahasuerus' kingdom. Notice that Haman, like so many powerful men, is easily offended. He's got an ego so large that it's easy to bruise. He's so inflated his opinion of himself, it doesn't take much to pop it. How easily offended are you? I really want you to think about that. How easy are you to offend? You know, as Christians, to become Christians, here's what we say. That my sin, my personal sin, is so great that God had to send his son to become a human and had to die in my place so that I could be forgiven. So I acknowledge, if I'm a Christian, I have to acknowledge my sin is so great that the Son of God had to die, and I'll acknowledge that somehow, for some reason, God still loves me. if I acknowledge those things, what could someone possibly say about me worse than that? No matter what someone says about me, whether it's true or false, no matter what they say about me, is it worse than God's son had to die because of you? So why would we be easily offendable people? Like, we live in a culture where everyone's offended by everything. We're looking for reasons to be offended. This should not be the culture here. This should be a place where people are hard to offend. Don't try. I'm not encouraging you to try. But it should be a place where we're hard. You know what? We give each other the benefit of the doubt. We look around each other and say, you know what? You know what's true about them? They're so bad, God had to die for them. And they know it. And we say the same thing about us. And so we're not easily offendable. But Haman, his fragile ego, it leads him to convince the king, using lies, deceit, and distortion, to issue an order that will see the destruction of an entire race of people. Verse 7, in the first month, the month of Nisan, in King Ahasuerus' 12th year, the Pur, that is, the lot, was cast before Haman for each day in each month. And it fell in the 12th month, the month Adar. Then Haman informed King Ahasuerus, there is one ethnic group scattered throughout the peoples in every province of your kingdom, keeping themselves separate. Their laws are different from everyone else's, and they do not obey the king's laws. So it is not in the king's best interest to tolerate them. If the king approves, let an order be drawn up authorizing their destruction. And I will pay 375 tons of silver to the officials for deposit in the royal treasury. Just a side note, if it's a just law, you probably don't have to bribe the king. Verse 10, the king removed his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman, son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. And the king told him, the money and the people are given to you to do with as you see fit. Notice Haman never tells the king who these people are that are so insidious. And the king never asks. So one manipulates, and the other is easy to manipulate. The supposedly most powerful man, the king of Persia, again, he lets someone else make a decision. In fact, he authorized her killing because he's told it's not in his best interest, even though he just married a Jew and his life was just saved by a Jew. Both of these powerful men are overgrown children. One is distracted by the offer of shiny things, and the other, he throws a temper tantrum because people don't recognize him as being special. Friends, this is a world we live in, and the Bible doesn't ignore it, excuse it, or imagine it away. We live in a world where those who rise to power are often the most unfit to lead. The leaders of Persia, these two men, remind me of Lord Farquaad in the movie Shrek. He's supposed to be this mighty leader, and the first time he shows up on this grand horse, and when he gets off the horse, he's half the size of a normal man. And he spends the rest of the movie, everything he does is based upon his own insecurity. So Haman gets his way. The orders are drawn up, and in this perverse imitation of the Great Commission, the news of the Jews' destruction is sent out to all the peoples in all the tongues. And the chapter ends this way. That as Haman and the king get drunk, the city that they're supposed to rule, that they're supposed to lead, is in turmoil because of the decision they made. So the stage is set. The characters are in place. What will happen next? I learned this in vacation Bible school. You've got to come back next week to see how the story concludes. Now, before we end, I want to point out two lessons from these chapters. Here's lesson number one. The story of Esther is the story of an ancient conflict. This is not primarily a personal feud between two men, Haman and Mordecai. By pointing us back to their ancestors, King Saul and King Agag, what this does is it places this story within this ongoing conflict that began in the Garden of Eden. So in the Garden of Eden, you have the serpent who lies to Eve. He leads mankind into sin. He convinces them that God doesn't have what's best for them. They listen. They fall into this temptation, and so God comes, and with it comes the news of judgment. But he promises this. In the garden, he promises even Adam, he says this, I'm going to send a son. And this son, he is going to crush the head of the serpent. He's going to crush everything that's evil, and he's going to restore, he's going to reshape, he's going to remake my creation into something even greater. And so that conflict between the serpent and the coming son has been the story that the Bible tells, beginning in Genesis and all the way to the end of the book. Now let's think about the book of Revelation. Because in the book of Revelation, this conflict was described, if you remember in chapter 12, it was described as a pregnant woman who's on the run from a dragon who's waiting for her to give birth so he can devour the baby. Sort of an odd story, but it's a revelation. We got used to those, right? What was that saying? Well, it's going all the way back to that conflict in the Garden of Eden, that God had promised a son who was going to crush the serpent's head. So what's the serpent, what's the dragon going to do? He's going to try to stop that promise from coming to pass. Like Satan's plan to defeat God's promise is to stop the birth of the Messiah. And so what's the best way to do that? Try to wipe out God's people. Then the Messiah can't be born. And so Haman, we can't just look at him as this egotistical political leader. We're supposed to see him as a pawn of Satan thrown into an ancient conflict. And so his lust to kill the Jews, which is insane. I mean, that what he does is insane. Hey, this guy offended me. Find out where he's from. Oh, he's from this nation. Kill them all. I mean, is that rational thinking? You read that on the news, what do you think? That dude is crazy. Like, they got to get rid of him. Yeah, it's crazy. So where's this lust to kill the Jews come from? It's born from Satan's, the desire of Satan to prevent his ultimate crushing at the hand of God's son. So Esther, we chose Esther, you know why? Because this is the same story as the story of Revelation. What do we learn in Revelation? That the beast under the influence of the dragon is trying to crush God's people. And what do God's people do in the face of such hostility? Endure with patience and purity. That's the story of Esther. It's the very same story. So let me ask you this question. Will the serpent, I know we haven't gotten there yet. You probably read ahead, spoiled the story. It's okay. It's okay if you read the Bible ahead. Will the serpent be successful in killing all the Jews and in nullifying God's promise to redeem his people, to restore his world? Will he be successful? Well, if we've only read through verse 3, we don't know. And the Jews here, right, they're living it, so they don't know. But they should. Because once God makes a promise, what's true? That promise will come to pass. And we see this hinted at already in a couple ways. Here's the first way. The date the decree is issued is on the 13th day of the first month of the year. Now that probably doesn't mean anything to you. Let's put it in our terms. We'll say January 13th. Okay? January 13th. You're like, oh, what's significant about that? Do you know what starts every year on January 14th? The Passover celebration. So the Jews, on January 13th, they get a decree which says, this nation, this evil empire has authorized your destruction. And the very next day, they go to bed that night. They're not sleeping well. I can't believe it's going to happen. What are we going to do? They go to bed. They wake up the next morning and they say, oh yeah, it's time to start a week-long celebration. What are we celebrating, Dad? We're celebrating the time in our past where an evil empire made a decree to kill all of our young men so that our nation would be destroyed. And what happened? Well, we're here. God didn't allow it to happen. Like, so this timing of it is not, it's not just random. It's not by chance. Like, they're celebrating God's deliverance from a previous plot to annihilate them on the very same moment where they're receiving this decree. The second indication that God's promises will not fail is this, that the pagan king is saved at the end of chapter 2 by an exile. So you have an exile who's seeking the good of someone else. He's unrewarded for his righteousness and is sentenced to death on a tree. Does that sound familiar? In fact, in this gospel, the good news that goes out to the nations, we find that God will save his people through what appears to be weakness, that victory is won through sacrifice, the way up is the way down, to be humble is to be exalted, the cross leads to glory, death leads to resurrection. And this is the story told over and over in the Old Testament. Just think about Joseph. Joseph is cast into a pit, he's brought out of the pit. What does he do? Well, he saves someone's life. And what do? They forget about him. But he ends up being exalted to this position so that he can deliver God's people from famine. Or David. David is the least of Jesse's son. He wins this great victory over the giant. And what the reward does he get for that? He gets hunted for 10 years by the king. And finally, he's exalted to king himself, and he leads Israel into this time of unparalleled prosperity. Like, this is the pattern. And why is it this pattern? It's preparing us for the coming of Jesus, that when God sends his son into the world, that he will come and he will embrace weakness as the way to salvation. So at this point in the story of Esther, the scene is set, the peace are in places, the tension is building. But in one sense, we, like they, we wouldn't have to give in to the anxiety wondering what's going to happen, because God made a promise. And his promises don't fail. Here's the second lesson. The story of Esther is the story of God's providence. God's name is never mentioned in the book of Esther, but his fingerprints are everywhere. Why is Esther looked upon with favor by everyone she meets? We're not really told, are we? But we can see God's handiwork, that God seems to be putting her in position to do something important. Why does Mordecai just happen to find himself at the gates? He just happens to overhear a plot to assassinate king. He just happens to have the connections to get the message to the king, and he just happens, therefore, to save the king's life. How did all that just happen? Well, where some see chance, we see God at work. We see purpose. How about this? When the lot or the pur is cast, it says they go through every month. Like, oh, it's the first month. Is it gonna? Are we gonna execute them tomorrow? Nope. What about next month? Nope. What about next month? Nope. What about next month? Keep getting nopes until the final one, which is the maximum amount of time between the decree and when the decree is going to be executed. Now, why does that come up at the most favorable month for the Jews? Well, the answer is, of course, pure luck. Random chance. It's a die. You can't determine where the die goes or where the lot is cast, except we know Proverbs 16:33, which says the lot is cast into the lap, but it's every decision is from the Lord. I strongly believe that the reason God's name is not mentioned in the book of Esther is to teach us the very same lesson that we are supposed to be learning when we were supposed to be learning when we went through the book of Revelation. We need to learn to see the world as it is, not how it appears. So the first time you read the book of Esther, you sit down, you read those 10 chapters, what you see is like, oh, God's absent. He's nowhere to be found. But that's not how it really is. That's just how it appears. Because the more you read and the more God opens your eyes, the more you see the kind and gracious hand of providence everywhere. Amen. Brothers and sisters, God is always working. He is never silent. He is never still. We may not always see what he is doing, but that's because of our lack of sight, not his lack of ability. This working of God in ways that is not always obvious is what Christians have called providence. And it's something we find great comfort and hope in, is in the providence of God, the working of God when it's not as evident or obvious, God working even maybe when his name is not mentioned. I want to end by reading a question and answer from the Heidelberg Catechism. So this was written in 1563 in Germany during the Protestant Reformation. So this is a time when two things are happening simultaneously, that God's people are being persecuted. As they uncover the gospel and they're proclaiming the truth, they're getting persecuted, but God is also working in a very powerful way to bring light and salvation to people. So as this is happening, some Christians sit down and they write these series of questions and answers that are to encourage Christians to continue to trust God, hold on to the truth, even while they're suffering. And so what they would do is they would memorize these questions and answers to anchor their lives and their hearts and their hope in Christ during times of doubt, fear, uncertainty. I think this would be a great question and answer for us all to memorize. So here's the question. What do you understand by the providence of God? What does it mean when we say the providence of God? And listen to this answer. The almighty and ever-present power of God, by which God upholds as with his hand heaven and earth and all creatures, and so rules them that leaf and blade, rain and drought, fruitful and lean years, food and drink, health and sickness, prosperity and poverty, all things, in fact, come to us not by chance, but but by his fatherly hand. Even when we can't see how God is working, we can trust that he is working to keep his promises and to redeem his people. Let's pray to this Father whose hand we can trust. Father, I do pray that you'll give us faith to trust you. Lord, I hate to admit it, but I often see myself more in Haman and Ahasuerus because they're so blinded by what they see. Like they're blinded by what they perceive as physical beauty, as icons of material success. Shiny silver and gold objects. This is what they see and this is what they think is important. And I see in myself too much of that, where I trust what I can see way too much. So Lord, I pray that you'll give me and you'll give my brothers and sisters here faith to see things as they are, not how they appear. That we will see your hand at work and we will trust you. That our faith will be in your promises, that we'll hold tightly to them and not be distracted by all of these things around us. That even in times of suffering, in times where there's injustice, in times where others may be hurting us or harming us, that instead of throwing up our hands in despair, instead of trying to solve everything ourselves, that we will remember your promises. And we will trust that you are the God who is in control, that every single action falls under your providence. Lord, that it is not, anything in our life does not come to us by chance, but it's in your fatherly hand. Help us to trust you. In your name, amen.
Thank you for listening to this message from Redeemer Community Church in Fuquay-Varina, North Carolina. Feel free to make copies of this message to give to others, but please do not charge for those copies or alter the content in any way without permission. For more sermons, we invite you to visit us online at redeemernc.org.